Okay, I think we will get going. First of all, good morning. I'm Darrell West. I'm Vice President and Director of Governance Studies here at Brookings, and I would like to welcome you to this forum on customer-driven medicine. Now, this is the week where the Senate Finance Committee is expected to approve its version of healthcare reform. This will be the last of the five congressional committees actually to act in this area. The action then will move to the floors of both the House and Senate, and we will see what comes out of that process. But our goal today on healthcare is a little different. We'd actually like to step back from the specifics of the various legislative proposals and talk more generally about how digital and mobile technologies can improve healthcare. Quietly, over the last few years, a revolution has been unfolding in healthcare that has the potential to put consumers in charge of their medical care. There have been advances in smartphones. There's been the development of remote monitoring devices, the use of electronic medical records, and the rise of social networking sites for people suffering from chronic illnesses. And when you take all of these developments together, they form the basis for a new kind of healthcare system. Today at Brookings, we released a copy of a paper which describes the possibilities for customer-driven medicine. I won't go through all the findings. You can pick up a copy at the back if you haven't already done so. But before we move to our panel, I do want to mention a few highlights from that study. I think one of the problems of our current medical system is that we have a very expensive healthcare system, but only average health outcomes. You know, if you do kind of the two-by-two matrix, this is the worst box to be in: high cost and average outcomes. The United States spends over $6,000 annually per patient per capita, which is almost double what Canada, France, and the United Kingdom spend on each of their patients. But despite these very high healthcare outlays, we rank 42nd among developing nations in life expectancy. We actually rank behind the Cayman Islands, Andorra, and most European nations. And you can look at a variety of other health indicators as well. We generally are in the middle of the pack. So the question is, how do we raise quality while also cutting costs? Now, some people say this is an impossible proposition, that if you cut costs, you're also going to cut quality. I don't think that that is the case. I think what people fail to realize is that we need to use technology to change the organization and structure of healthcare and change the incentive structure so that people have more positive inducements for constructive behavior. And I think this is true for everybody involved in healthcare, from the patient to the physician to hospitals. When you look at some of the new technologies that have developed, you no longer need to go to doctors for every aspect of your healthcare. Companies are now making what they call wearable monitors that record vital signs and transmit them electronically to physicians. There are monitors that record blood pressure and heart rate on a continuous basis. In the area of diabetes, where there are over 24 million sufferers, and diabetes is, you know, is the seventh leading cause of death in the United States, there are devices that record glucose levels at home and then electronically send them to the appropriate healthcare provider. Now, when you just think about this one simple area of healthcare innovation, this is the type of thing that puts patients in charge of routine medical data collection. It keeps them out of the doctor's office until they need more serious care. And I think this is the vision for the future. If we want to save costs without compromising the quality of care, there are ways we can use technology to kind of do the routine aspects of record keeping, e-prescribing, making appointments, monitoring healthcare symptoms, and then when we really do need a physician and higher quality medical care, then we can go into the system. Another problem in the healthcare area is just a simple fact: people forget to take their prescription drugs. There have been studies showing that only 50% of patients take their medication as prescribed. Either they forget to take the drug entirely, or they don't take the medication at the dosage level that has been prescribed by their physician. Doctors now can send personalized reminders through email, automated phone calls or text messages telling people when to take their pills. If a patient has a memory problem, which increasingly is the case with many senior citizens, some companies make what they call digestible chips, which can be swallowed along with prescription. There are no side effects from this chip, we are told. And the chip then electronic informs the physician that either the person has or has not taken their medication. National surveys show that patients would like to employ digital technologies in their medical care, and they feel that this actually would save money. There's a very interesting study by Bob Lighton of the Brookings Institution a couple years ago that found Americans could save as much as $197 billion over the next 25 years just through the use of remote monitoring devices. This is especially true in the case of the leading chronic diseases. But we need policy changes that help us take advantage of these new advances. You know, it's one thing to have all these new cell phones and smartphones and remote monitoring devices and electronic medical records, but unless we have policy changes that really facilitate and reimburse physicians for using these cost-saving devices, we are not going to be able to take full advantage of these new advances. We need reimbursement changes by insurance companies that pay for mobile health applications and digital communications. In many states, physicians don't get reimbursed for anything electronic. You know, if they do e-consultations with patients, they do not get reimbursed for that. We need to focus on positive health outcomes and preventive medicine as a way to save money. There have been pilot studies in a number of areas and in a number of medical providers that have found cost reductions of 5 to 10%. So the potential for cost savings is very substantial. In the paper, I suggest that we need to think about good health rewards for people leading healthy lifestyles. You know, in the auto insurance area, we have good driving discounts. You know, if you haven't gotten a speeding ticket or haven't been involved in an accident over a period of time, then you get a discount on your insurance premium. You know, we need to be thinking about that type of approach to health insurance as well. You know, if you're getting regular exercise and having your annual checkup and not smoking and watching your weight and doing all the things that we know are associated with positive health outcomes, you should be rewarded for that. So I think there are a variety of ways that we can think about this in a way that will promote better health care and also achieve the national objective of better care at the same time that we're able to cut costs. What I'd like to do today is now turn to our experts to address issues related to healthcare innovation and just some of the new ideas that are out there that will help inform policymakers when they are thinking about these issues. So to address these issues, we have brought together two leading voices. On my right, I'd like to introduce Ellen Blackler. Ellen is the Executive Director for Public Policy at AT&T. She is a leading writer and thinker on issues related to healthcare and broadband policy. And then on my left is Dr. Karen Ruben, who is a Senior Associate Dean for Continuing Medical Education and External Affairs at the University of Virginia Hospital. She actually is a person who has many titles. It'll take me 5 minutes to run through all of her titles. But it's a sign of her great accomplishments. She's the medical director for the Office of Telemedicine and also president of the American Telemedicine Association. But she informed me right before this event one of her most important jobs remains being a pediatrician. She's a professor of pediatrics at the University of Virginia, but also a clinical practitioner. So she actually sees patients, practices telemedicine, and has done a number of very innovative things as well. So I'd like to start with Ellen. You know, you have thought a lot about healthcare innovation, especially in the area of broadband, some of the personalized devices that are developing. You know, what are the opportunities for technology, and then also what are the barriers to wider adoption of new technologies?
So I can talk maybe a minute about some of the technology development that the industry is working on and then about the barriers, because that's, of course, always the problem. In Daryl's paper, he laid out this kind of vision of what personalized medicine could be like, and I brought some toys to show you all so that sometimes it's good to get a visual. In the technology industry, of course, we sell broadband connectivity, wired and wireless, and non-broadband connectivity, so we spend a lot of time thinking about ways y'all could be using that, so you want to buy more of it. And one of the real opportunities that the industry is focused on is in the medicine field. And we and some of the other technology companies recognized early on that one of the things that would need to happen is the development of standards for interoperability so that all the innovators out there could be inventing new applications and new devices that could be used over our networks. And so I'll get up my little box of tricks here. One of the... So this is a what really looks like a cable modem, but is a special device really developed for medicine, medical applications that collects data from a lot of the kind of remote monitoring devices that you hear about. And it collects it over a new standard called the Zigbee standard, which you would never need to know about if you were a real person. And the thing about the Zigbee standard is it operates at a very low power and so lets the devices that would be needed for remote monitoring to have a very small battery, and the battery could last a very long time. So the vision is you could put this in your home and it would collect all kinds of information through this little antenna, and then either through your typical internet connection, it could send the information back to your practitioner, you know, weekly, daily, in real time, however it was programmed to do that. One of the interesting things that we've been working on with one of our technology partners is this ShoeSoul, which I've practiced saying for 24 hours now. And what it does is that it senses, senses balance and movement in the foot. And it's really designed as an independent living tool to, as I'm sure you're familiar with the data or from personal experience about the fall issue with elderly folks, it's lots of times what is really a barrier to living at home and can be the thing that sends people into an institution. So this device really serves a couple purposes. It can be diagnostic. You can, you know, if someone is wearing it, you can see changes in their balance over time. And then also, if there's an actual fall, and the doctor's saying, did you know why you fell? Did you trip? Did you fall forward? Did you fall back? The patient frequently doesn't know or is wrong. And this can really provide a lot of data about exactly what caused the fall, which helps with the diagnosis going forward. So this is something that's under development with one of our technology partners, and we're now doing a study where we've got some patients in a facility wearing them to try to get the data on kind of the baseline data that would be used in detection. So if you can envision a patient or a person in the home with access to this kind of technology for, you know, blood pressure, weight gain, you know, on congestive heart failure, if a patient is weighing themselves every day, and this were automatically collecting the information, and if it reached a certain threshold sending a message back, you would really be immediately seeing the change in the patient's status that would require some kind of intervention and avoid, you know, a bad outcome. So this is the kind of thing that is going on out there. It's very exciting, but we still have these really pedestrian, kind of a joke, pedestrian problem. On getting it adopted, and Karen and I were talking beforehand about kind of the frustration for her, obviously, as a practitioner, of seeing these very simple things that could be fixed, and yet we're still talking about them 15, 20 years later. So Karen will talk more about that. But I'll just tick through what I think of as the main kind of critical success factors, trying to be more positive than barriers. First is we need this really robust infrastructure. You know, we need a robust internet, we need it to people's homes, we need wireless and wireline. That takes a lot of investment. AT&T, we've invested about $40 million over the last couple of years in our network, another 17 or 18 this year. So the companies are out there doing that. But it's really difficult to overstate the increase in demand that we're facing. And I have a couple of fun numbers that I like to toss out there. So people, we like big numbers in healthcare, right? That data usage on the mobile network has increased 5,000% in the past 3 years. And that's before we have all this stuff out in the field. And in 2010, they predict that your average 20 households will be as much internet traffic as the entire internet in 1995. And my new favorite is that as of January, 15 hours of video is uploaded onto YouTube every minute. And so that is the equivalent of 86,000 movies a week if Hollywood released them. So you can see that the scale of the investment needed in broadband is really substantial. Secondly, is we need to keep promoting innovation in the applications and development of the necessary standards for interoperability so that the applications that the practitioners can envision can be developed in, you know, for any different number of companies. And then thirdly is really all of the healthcare issues that really come down to getting paid. Today, it's very difficult for doctors who use this stuff to figure out a way to get paid for it. You've got the reimbursement problems. You've got the licensing problems. You've got there's still language in a lot of places that requires things to be done in person. You know, there's no reason they need to be done in person. So it's kind of, we've got to get rid of that in-person bias and then actively support reimbursement elsewhere. So I'll stop there for now.
Thank you. I like that show and tell aspect of your presentation. Karen, you are an expert on telemedicine. First of all, maybe you should explain to us what telemedicine is for people who may not be up on this. And then secondly, what role can telemedicine play in access, quality, and cost savings?
Okay, thank you. It's a real privilege to be here, and it's fun to work with Ellen again. When in her previous life at the FCC, we worked together in broadband deployment, and so it's really a privilege. I'm awed by this group. So I'm a country doctor. I'm a pediatric cardiologist, and I spent most of my career driving all over the Commonwealth of Virginia to provide care to children in need. For those of you who live in the metro Washington area, believe it or not, Virginia is a very rural state, and we find over and over again that patients in rural communities have limited to no access in their local communities to specialty care, and so telemedicine is a tool to provide that type of care. And it ranges from live interactive video conferencing and exchange face-to-face consultations with a specialist, a subspecialist. It also can be store and forward technologies, images captured and transmitted asynchronously for interpretation by the specialist. And it also includes, as we're learning today, remote monitoring, home telehealth, and on-body mobile devices, which can capture data and transmit that data to the appropriate places, whether it's a home health agency, whether it's a specialty care provider. Telemedicine is a terrific tool, and I can say firsthand I have used it. I use it every day to provide care to patients throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia. Telemedicine programs exist in every single state and in many nations across the globe. But we face many challenges in getting it integrated into mainstream healthcare, and that's why I'm delighted to be up here. Maybe I'll try not to whine too much. And the American Telemedicine Association plays a great role in trying to influence policy in that regard. So we face a lot of challenges, but we can provide specialty services in probably more than 50 specialties and subspecialties. You can get 24-hour access to clinical services that are not available, and I'll give you some examples. We and others provide emergency access to a stroke neurologist. Stroke is the number three cause of death in the United States. Patients in rural communities don't have access to the same specialty care for stroke. When time is brain, from the onset of a symptom of a stroke, if you can get access to a clot-busting therapy, you can save the brain. So telemedicine programs can provide that type of care, and yet Medicare doesn't reimburse for those types of services. Access to dermatology services, emergency or non-emergent. We know that in many communities it takes 6 months to get an appointment with a dermatologist. Using both store and forward or live interactive video conferencing, a patient in a remote community can have access to a dermatologist immediately. Cancer outreach. We know that patients in rural communities don't necessarily have access to cancer clinical trials. Digital mammography services. We bring a mobile digital mammography van out to rural and remote communities in Appalachia and provide mammography services, plug into our community health center networks, and beam the images back to our mammographers who can provide a report to that patient the same day. How many of us, even in urban areas, get our mammography report back immediately? These are the types of things that we can do with telemedicine. So screening at home. You heard Ellen talk about screening for diabetes and blood pressure monitors and weight. There's a lot of data out there that shows that this is a very cost-effective method of providing preventive care, ongoing care, and interventions as well. Even remote telesurgery can be done. So a lot of opportunities, and we just absolutely are desperate for an alignment of policies to make it worth. And when I say policies, I mean Medicare policies, Medicaid policies, insurance reimbursement by the third-party payers. Private payers in many states don't reimburse for these types of services. And now with healthcare reform, there is so much that can be done and so many opportunities. So we can talk about that as the session goes on. And rural broadband deployment, critical, not only to our hospitals, to our community health centers, our health departments, but to the patients' homes as well. So we have a lot of opportunities, challenges as well, but this is the wave of the future, and I'm really hopeful and optimistic that we get it right.
So okay, now each of you have talked about the importance of integrating some of these new advances into a mainstream medicine, but yet some of the problems in terms of policies by insurance companies as well as the federal government. So I'd like to ask the same question for to each of you, starting first with Ellen. What do you think the federal government should be doing in this area? I mean, you know, we're having this big national debate over healthcare reform, although surprisingly, health IT has been a small part of that discussion. What should the federal government be doing?
Well, we've been really focused on the idea of the government creating, you know, kind of leadership of using these public health care programs to, you know, so that Medicaid and Medicare are reimbursing for these services and really focusing on those kinds of issues. And there's so much that is clear that could be done. We were chatting before about the VA has a really good experience and a lot of data to show that if this is successful, keeps people out of the hospital, keeps people out of institutions, reduces the cost. And the patients are happy, and yet you can't get the same things reimbursed in the other public programs. So I think there's a real, what I think of as leadership opportunity in the public programs to lead the way, just like they've done in some of the other technology, you know, really with the adoption issue on health records, you know, the incentive payments. There's lots of things that government can do in the way that it structures the way these healthcare programs are delivered. I don't want to steal Karen's thunder because I know she has some good numbers about how little has been spent on telemedicine over the last couple of years. It's shocking. And so I'll hand it over to her to shock you.
We're clicking, clacking, clapping, brothers. Yeah, so I agree 100% Medicare reimbursement. They say as Medicare goes, so goes the nation, so goes the third-party payers. So in 1997, the Balanced Budget Amendment had a provision for reimbursement of telehealth services. By 2000, only $17,000 worth of telemedicine services or encounters were actually reimbursed by the federal government. So in 2000, BIPA 2000, which was the Benefits Improvement and Protection Act, authorized CMS to reimburse and expand reimbursement for telehealth services. And we can get great statute, but oftentimes the regulations create additional barriers. And in the ensuing 9 years, we've now only reached out to receive $2 million per year of Medicare reimbursement for telemedicine because of some statutory issue, but primarily regulatory barriers for telehealth. So we have a long way to go if the federal government is only spending $2 million a year in Medicare reimbursement, and yet we know there are tremendous cost savings. We also know that Medicare is spending a fortune on readmission for the same diagnosis. It's gotten a great deal of press, New England Journal of Medicine article in April talking about tremendous expenditures, readmission in 30-day, 60-day, and 90-day. You know, 40% of Medicare beneficiaries are readmitted for the same diagnosis, and billions of dollars that can be saved remote monitoring tools can clearly be effective. You can monitor your blood pressure of your patient every day at home, daily weights, oxygen saturation, even EKG monitors. I've seen the West Wireless Institute did a demonstration of a Band-Aid that measures oxygen saturation, EKG, even patient falls. I mean, these technologies are here now, and yet it's really not a covered service, so we can't really incentivize providers to adopt these technologies if they can't be paid to spend the time interpreting the data and using that data in everyday health care. Medicaid is another agency that hasn't formally defined telehealth. So the Medicaid programs actually pay for telemedicine. I know that in 1999, when I approached Virginia Medicaid, the states make the determinations of coverage for Medicaid, even though 50% of the funds for Medicaid come from the federal government. So we approached Virginia Medicaid armed with the data that because they are by statute required to pay for transportation of patients, it would make great sense for the Medicaid programs to pay for telemedicine services. And so we approached Virginia Medicaid and said, we had the data, $59 million spent in Virginia and in all the states on taxicabs and ambulances, and yet they were not covering telemedicine services. And they very quickly adopted it, and Virginia stepped to the front of the pack, actually, and covered telemedicine services for Medicaid beneficiaries, even in urban and rural areas, whereas Medicare only covers it for rural Medicare beneficiaries. So only 21% of Medicare beneficiaries can benefit from telemedicine, and even then there are some statutory barriers, limitations in terms of who the eligible consultants consultants and the originating sites. So again, a large way to go. And in terms of private pay, only 10 states have a mandate for private pay reimbursement of telehealth services. Again, major challenges. Other challenges, the rural health care program, we are, you may or may not realize that when you look at your telephone bill, there's a universal service fund provision on there, and we are greatly appreciative because the rural health care program of the Federal Communications Commission allows for discounted communication services for specific rural health care providers, so clinics and rural hospitals. But that program is somewhat broken as well and needs some another relooking. And I think part of the problem we have on the federal level is we have many silos who have invested in telemedicine, but there's not been interagency coordination and collaboration. So I could get under U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Utility Service funding for telemedicine equipment for a community that looks rural, acts rural, smells rural in Southwest Virginia in the middle of Appalachia, a county with no hospital. And yet, by CMS's definition, it's an urban area because of its adjacency to a city in the next state. That community has nothing but community health centers, and yet I can't be paid to provide the consultations in that community health center. And until very recently, I couldn't even get discounted telecom to that community health center because it didn't fit under the FCC's definition of rural. So we're pleading for interagency collaboration so that we can bring these services to patients in need.
Okay, now each of you have made the argument that the current system does not really encourage or reimburse some of these new advances. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the healthcare bills that are winding their way through Congress now. Is there any hope if any of these bills pass that that's going to change in the future?
Well, we're always hopeful. I think it still has a long way to go. You know, we've been working to get some of this language in, to get some, you know, those in-person words out and to get, to the extent people are doing studies and pilots, you know, to make sure that they've got telehealth and remote monitoring, whatever the buzzwords will be in there. I would say it's a funny issue. Karen probably spends more time on the Hill about it than I do, in that no one opposes, but there's so much kind of focus on some of the more controversial big issues that it does, in my mind, get a little bit lost in the shuffle in spite of the need for cost savings. So it's a little bit of a phenomena that maybe is a function of Congress that, you know, something that doesn't really have any detractors still has trouble getting through the mix. I don't know.
Yeah, and I'll point to Gary Capistran, who's the Senior Director of Public Policy for the American Telemedicine Association. I think he's worn out his shoes up on the Hill in the last several months. You know, part of our challenge is we know this is the right thing to do. Our problem is the Congressional Budget Office continues to score things out of the park when, in truth, they don't factor in cost savings. They only factor in utilization for the entire population. So every time we try to address some of these challenges, it's scored out of the park and dropped. One of the things
Could you explain that in a little more detail, the CBO scoring and what the problem is there?
Right. So CBO puts a price tag on our requests. So even just expanding the definition of rural was scored at hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And so in these bills, they say, well, sorry, it's too expensive for just the telehealth provisions. So we're trying to address some of the regulatory challenges. Another challenge we face, which I didn't talk about, is CMS has a regulation related to credentialing and privileging. That's a tremendous barrier for us. It's their hospital conditions of participation standards. And that CMS requirement requires every one of my doctors at my hospital, so 800 UVA doctors who are on call for telemedicine 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, would have to be credentialed and privileged at every single hospital in our network. That would cost so much money, take so much time, and the truth is these little hospitals, including critical access hospitals that might have 25 beds, don't have the staff or the doctors within their own staff to review the credentials and privilege of our subspecialists. So that's a tremendous barrier. So we've been working to try and introduce legislation that will direct CMS to relieve us of that burden, in addition to many of our other requests, which is to expand the originating sites, to expand we really would love to have elimination of rural requirement under Medicare, and to even bring Medicaid into the fold if possible.
So let's be optimistic. Let's assume these advances are going to continue. At some point, there will be policy changes that will encourage the adoption and reimbursement of this. How would these advances affect people's daily lives? You know, if you're an average family of four in the United States and this stuff was being utilized, how would it affect them?
Well, I think, you know, the kind of the poster child for envisioning a lot of this on the telemedicine and the remote monitoring side is the chronic conditions, and certainly in the elderly. You know, diabetes is a good example, or congestive heart failure, where daily things have to be done. Daily data has to be collected, but it doesn't require a daily intervention by a professional, and you don't need a professional to collect the data. And, you know, I was at an event recently where a little girl with diabetes talked about what she used to have to do, and she had a little, you know, dog-eared notebook where she wrote down her sugar levels and then bring the notebook to the doctor, who would, you know, look at it, looking at these numbers on the page, and try to draw a conclusion in that doctor's visit. And her life changed dramatically when she, not even with a, you know, Band-Aid device, she was just able to put it in at the end of the day and see a chart. And so she could see visually the changes, the doctor could see visually the changes, and this 12-year-old was talking about how it completely changed her compliant behaviors because the line meant a lot more to her than these figures on the page. So if you kind of multiply that by, you know, the possibilities, if you think about a patient with congestive heart failure who is weighing themselves every day and possibly has, you know, cognitive issues and sight issues, and are the numbers on the scale big enough, and then they remember to do it every day. And if you had a system where they weigh themselves every day, and if they didn't, they got a phone call. Or the other example we've been using with kids and diabetes is that there are these Bluetooth-enabled meters that can send the reading directly into a database. Not that someone would look at it every time, but if the database didn't get that reading, the kid gets a text message on the phone. And the kids always have their phones, and it is really increasing their compliance with doing their reading. And you could even take it a step further and send them a message depending on the reading, you know, good job, or you need to be more careful today, or and seeing that those kind of things really change. So you not only increase compliant behaviors, but you remove these logistical barriers to people getting care. They don't have to get the car, they don't have to make the appointment. You've got people, you know, elderly people who are spending a lot of time on this ministerial business of healthcare, and it removes both the time barrier and then actually presents the information in a way that's more usable to the person. And that, you know, there's a lot of talk about the personal responsibility element in healthcare and leading the more healthy lifestyle when, for, you know, a chronic condition or multiple chronic conditions, you don't always have, it's difficult to interpret sequential data over time in a way that makes sense to you, whereas some of these, you know, pictorial ways of showing the data would be really valuable. But I'm sure, I always feel like I'm overstepping when I'm on a panel with a doctor who can really tell you.
You're exactly right, actually. I ought to take you with me everywhere. you know, I think I have a lot of patients who have to drive many hours to come to the doctor. You know, it doesn't make sense. It's disruptive for families. Imagine if you have to take your loved one to see a specialist 6 or 7 hours away. It's incredibly inconvenient, and it's a hardship. You know, we think these technologies are perfect for aging gracefully in place, at home, and when if you have to go see a doctor, why do you have to travel many hours? So we also like to put in a plug for telemedicine being a green technology, because you don't have to spend time on the road using gasoline when you can just drive to your doctor's office and connect to the specialist. You know, we've just launched a high-risk obstetric program. We have only 4 or 5 places in the Commonwealth of Virginia where they have maternal-fetal medicine specialists, and yet we have women who have premature babies in rural and remote communities, and not even so rural and remote communities. And we've now instituted a program where a pregnant woman can go to the health department to access a maternal fetal medicine specialist. We know that delivering a premature baby is a huge hardship, a hardship for the family, a cost to society. If you can keep babies in utero, we know just keeping babies out of our NICU saves $30,000 a week just in the neonatal hospitalization, not to mention a lifetime of hardship. So why not use these technologies to provide those types of services to patients? It makes great sense. In Arkansas, there's a very robust program called the Arkansas Angels, and they've actually demonstrated a 26% reduction in infant mortality or neonatal mortality using these types of technologies. So this is not anything in the future. This is right now, and we just need to align our policies with the right now. And those are the types of impacts on families. And save families from the burden of stroke when you can intervene immediately as opposed to missing that, those golden 3 hours of when you can provide clot-busting therapies to patients when time is brain. Just, I can name specialty after specialty after specialty where these technologies can make a difference.
I'd like to ask about privacy and security concerns, because when we start talking about mobile communications, remote monitoring devices, you know, sending your glucose levels electronically to a doctor, a lot of people are worried about the privacy aspects of that. Like, you know, is my neighbor going to be able to intercept my heart record? Will confidential information get lost?
Yeah, and that's obviously a critical issue and one that there's a lot of technology solutions for, fortunately. And, you know, there's very robust rules, and I think that has brought a lot of focus on it in a good way. I know people have frustrations with some of the rules, but interestingly, I think if you move to an electronic environment, some of the compliance becomes easier. You've got, if you think about the security of a paper record, it's not particularly secure. And if we get into a more electronic environment, you've got electronic encryption, you've got ways to electronically track who has accessed the data. You know, one of the big kind of leakage potentials in a facility is you've got people who are authorized to look at data, maybe not that particular piece of data, and you have no way of knowing who opened what file drawer and who looked in it. And electronically, we can do that. We can tell you who looked, when, how long they were in. And so in a lot of ways, the electronic transfer all the stuff to an electronic system actually provides you better compliance opportunity. And I think there's also a lot of potential to manage consent in a more layered way. So, you know, patients can be giving specific consent to specific practitioners in particular circumstances and withholding it in other circumstances in a way that is very difficult to do when you go and sign that paper that you don't really even look at when you go to the doctor's office annually. So it's both opportunity and then prevents a whole new kind of, you know, risk, because you've obviously got different breach problems than if it's sitting only in a doctor's office. But, you know, I feel a little like, maybe I'm obviously biased being at a technology company, but, you know, in many other areas we have, you know, financial transactions have been handled, and well, identity theft is obviously a problem. The world's economy moves electronically, and I think we need to kind of stay cognizant that these problems can be solved as long as we're focused on them. And, you know, I think that's very consistent with a patient-centered. These kind of technologies can put the control back in the patient's hands, I think.
I agree 100% with everything Ellen said. And, you know, the digital transfer of information is critical. You know, as we're moving towards electronic health records, health information exchange, we're developing standards of interoperability for devices, and encryption is a major component of that, and patient privacy is obviously critical to all of us. But I think we can follow the model of the banking industry and go one step further. So it's important, it's critical, and people are working on this all the time.
Okay, why don't we open the floor to questions and comments from you. We have, I think, people with microphones. If you could give us your name, if you're with a particular organization, and we would also ask you if you could keep your comments and questions brief, just so we can get to more people. Yes, right there. Yep. Okay, yeah, the microphone is coming right up. This guy in the blue shirt right there.
I just have a question in terms of the monitored
end. Could you identify yourself?
Excuse me, I'm Fred Altman. In terms of the people at the end who are doing the monitoring, as this becomes a much larger effort, how much reorganization, I mean outside of the financial considerations, do you need to do in order to handle this?
Can I make a statement? I think your question is a perfect one. Imagine the tons of data that are coming in. So we're going to need computer algorithms to assist us to identify outliers, you know, and who's going to be interpreting it and who's sending the information to which provider, who's going to respond back to the patient. These are very important questions that have to be addressed. We're just launching our very first Habitat for Humanity home telehealth-enabled system in Charlottesville, and we're looking at, okay, where's the data going? It's going to go to our home health agency, but the patients who are living in those homes use providers that are not necessarily our physicians. So we have to make sure we can get that information and coordinate it in a user-friendly, simple process, because you're absolutely right. There's going to be a ton of data, and who's going to interpret it, who's going to screen it, and who's going to respond to it is a question we have to address.
I mean, my sense is doctors are going to have to really reconfigure their offices, because, you know, when you go into a physician's office now, they're really set up for personal interactions. You know, there's the receptionist who greets you, and then they enter your information, and then they have people running around. I think in the future, with especially as remote monitoring devices become more common, they're going to have to reconfigure their office to basically have people who are monitoring the monitors, and that will be as opposed to kind of reacting to the patient who walks in, doctors are going to have to become more proactive to kind of look at the data. They may have some automated means to kind of chart, you know, whose figures are kind of going outside the accepted boundaries and, you know, highlight that information. But, you know, that's just part of how the practice of medicine, I think, will have to change, and it'll be interesting just to see what the impact is on physicians and patients.
In truth, I think we're going to have to train a whole new set of health professionals. We have a huge shortage of physicians. I mean, we're expecting a shortage of up to 200,000 physicians by 2020. Aging population, retiring physicians, we're not opening very more medical schools. And so doctors' offices are very full. You know, people are very busy. So we're going to have to manage this information as in as organized a fashion as possible.
Yep.
Frank Torres with Microsoft. Some of our top executives who've taken a very strong interest in health IT and healthcare and health reform ask me just about on a daily basis. I think health reform and other things have been focused on the provider side. How do we get consumers, the patients, engaged? And they think that that's still kind of a gap that we have. And of course, those are probably the most important players in this whole thing to make it work. If we don't get the consumer in the home or the patient in the hospital or the healthcare provider engaged using these technologies, used to these technologies, the system really doesn't work. How do we get to the patient, to the consumer?
Well, I'll just share, when you look at the data of all these studies, there's always a little patient acceptance or a patient satisfaction measure. It's always good. I've never seen a study where there were good outcomes on cost and all this other stuff, and the patients didn't like it. And in fact, Dr. Max Stratura, who's kind of a mover and shaker in telemedicine, if you've heard him speak, always says that they have to convince the doctor. And the doctor's like, I don't know, it's not going to be as good, and I've got all kinds of problems. And they say to the patient, do you want to try this? And the patient says, okay. The patient loves it always wants to do it again. And there's never this kind of resistance on the patient side. And I'm sure, we've all seen the same thing. Over the last couple of years, I have seen a lot of change in my own doctors, in their kind of ability to share information and level of sharing. And it's always surprising and pleasant. I've never had a bad experience that was technology-based on the medical side. So I think some of it comes from adoption. And I think the internet revolution, when people see what can be done, adoption curves just, get blown out of the water. So I think as these tools become available, you'll see that, and people will become interested in a personal health care record. And, if they really could see their own data, I think you'll get people wanting to do that. So you're in that chicken and egg thing now where so much isn't available, and it's hard to get people excited about it. But, once it starts leaking out, I feel like that's going to be the smallest barrier that we have.
I think some of it is also training a new generation of health professionals. My kids taught me a whole lot about the internet, and I think that this next generation of physicians are going to be very comfortable with technology and embracing that with their own patients, and then this generation of patients is also going to be much more comfortable with technology. We do have a long ways to go, and I will make note, I've seen how many pharma advertisements on TV that have driven patients to ask for specific drugs. So I think insofar as we can promote advanced technologies in healthcare publicly in the media, I think we will drive adoption as well because patients will begin to ask those questions. But we need the providers to be comfortable as well.
Yep, we have a question over here. There's a microphone coming.
I'm Peter McManaman, a health economist from Silver Spring, Maryland. I think you have two challenges. One is the perception in the country that if it's not covered by insurance, it's not available, and that impedes both the docs from purchasing and the patients from buying. In fact, on that regard, you're probably better off that it's not a covered service because then you can sell it to patients when they want to have it, particularly the remote access. The other problem I think you have is the complexity of medicine. I mean, there are 7,000 active CPT codes. There are probably several hundred that are just for diagnostic tests and monitoring. So any one specific monitor is going to have a very small market. You're talking about 1% at most for most of the specific diagnostic tests. So what might be better is that AT&T box, if it were a general sort of switching system or sending system that entrepreneurs and developers could develop monitoring devices that would feed a standardized box that mm-hmm. could send signals to the doctor so that it wouldn't have to be a different box for each diagnosis, but you could have a separate monitor, a switching system that accepted a standardized record of some sort to send to a remote location, remote to a centralized doc, and then you could sell the box to patients because they don't want to drive 6 hours to get to a location, or they don't want to even go for 1 hour if it has to be three or four or five times a week. But if there is patient convenience, then you can get demand. And then once it starts to get adopted, particularly in a generalized fashion, then docs of all varieties can, you know, use the system. Different specialties could use the same system, just different interpretations on the monitoring signals.
Yeah, so let me just comment on our box. So this box is, it has our name on it, of course, because I brought it, but it actually operates on the Zigbee standard, which is, in the industry, we talk about it as interoperable. It's an open standard. Anyone can build a device to it. And in fact, it was developed by the Continua Alliance, which is a group of, I don't know, 200 technology companies, some big like AT&T and some small like the folks who are developing the Schussel. And that is the vision, that all of these things can feed into this box. You know, there's a lot of interest in the kind of app store model on the iPhone and, you know, medical applications on the iPhone where, you know, anyone is developing applications and if they're compatible, they can be downloaded. So I think that is both where the industry has generally and the vision for the medical device technology, and that's why you see a lot of focus on the standards and the interoperability. And the standards folks, you know, the standards committee and the people at ONC are articulating one of their goals is this technological neutrality and interoperability to allow that kind of thing. I think there's a great deal of concern in the provider community even about proprietary systems, largely driven because they don't want to invest in the wrong one. I think that that is where the industry is headed. And I will also say that we in at AT&T are thinking about how to work in the electronic medical records field and are moving towards a system. We have a product, not to do too much of a commercial, that really allows us to work with whatever medical record system the hospital has and kind of translate that so, you know, hospitals don't have to reinvest in something. So I think the tech community has heard loud and clear from the customers that that's a huge risk to them to have to decide in this emergent technology what to invest in. And so I think we won't see that as a big barrier going forward.
I would agree. The Continua Health Alliance has really worked hard to develop these standards of interoperability. And ATA has taken a role in terms of working with the specialty societies on practice guidelines and standards as well. We think that is the role of an organization such as ours. And, you know, fast forward 10 years, maybe your broadband provider sells your device as well. That's how to get the consumers hooked into it as well for an extra charge. You know, you have bundled services, TV, phone, healthcare access. Why not?
HBO, glucose monitoring device.
Exactly.
In the very back on the aisle.
I'm Brian Hensel. I'm a health policy fellow with Senator Jay Rockefeller. You've talked a bit about telemedicine consultations and functional and physiological monitoring, but what about use of web-enabled phones, iPhones, et cetera? What's the vision for those, and what's currently being done?
Interestingly, back to the other question, a lot of the really exciting stuff that goes on in the smartphone area doesn't go on with us because we're not the device inventor. We have a lot of partnerships with companies interested in doing things, and we like to encourage them and prompt them up. But in the end, a lot of that innovation goes on elsewhere and is compatible with what we're doing. There's fun stuff that we're involved in. I don't have my iPhone with me, but there's a technology being developed that is a projector that attaches, that you hook into your iPhone and it takes the image that, you know, is on your iPhone and can project it onto any surface so that you can, you know, have the x-ray and project it on the wall and do a consultation with people right there, and they're working on getting the resolution to, you know, a point that's useful medically, not just, you know, to show a movie to your friends. But so there's really all kinds of that stuff going on, and that is, I think, the holy grail of what you're trying to get to, is that it's seamlessly connected so that it's not hard. You know, we all know that your grandmother's not going to want to figure out that device or certainly even figure out a smartphone, but that for the practitioners, there's a lot of opportunity in packing as much into the one device as you can. So I don't know if you have any of those.
There are an amazing number of applications being developed for smartphones. I was at an mHealth conference a few months ago, and there were various companies that were exhibiting differing things they had, and it was mind-boggling just what you can do now through the existing technology. I mean, there are physicians who could download your electrocardiogram to their smartphone and basically, you know, give a second opinion. You know, say you're a patient in D.C. and the physician is in California, you know, you just electronically ship the information. They can download it to their smartphone, read it, offer an opinion. I think that's the type of thing that is going to be very transforming about the future practice of medical care. I mean, right now, we are really limited by geography. Like, you know, when we think we're in D.C., we have to go to a D.C. specialist. I think in the future, those types of geographic barriers are going to become less common, and we will have access to experts in other areas.
Although we do have licensure challenges right now, which do exist. Licensure is state-determined. So other than DOD and VA patients, we are constrained by state licensure. So I can't really provide medicine across the state border unless I get a license to practice medicine in that state, which is a very time-consuming process. We have been working with the Federation of State Medical Boards, but we have miles to go on that issue specifically. But in terms of the devices, you know, high-risk obstetric care, look at a CT scan, an EKG, tremendous applications that can be and have been developed already. And I think it's very important that all of these developers work with the specialty societies to be sure that the application itself is appropriate for the type of service provided.
So, I just want to add another really high potential technology is this whole cloud computing opportunity. And I think the opportunity on innovation for that is that a large company like ours can put functionality in the cloud that other people can then innovate off of. And they don't, I think of like the speech-to-text idea, and text-to-speech, that it has a lot of medical applications if people can simply explain their symptoms. That we're developing the capability to do the speech-to-text translation, have that in our network, but make it available to developers and other products to use. So, you know, how innovation works, AT&T is not going to be inventing every fabulous thing out there, but we have the resources to do some of this underlying technology. So it's kind of a combination of this innovation in the devices, you know, the smart doctor who invents some application that works for this very specific purpose, but isn't going to be able to have access to some of this really basic functionality the technology company like ours could make available in the cloud. So it's really this combination of business models, almost, of how you can make the technology available that I think gets to the really fun stuff out in the future. I hate to say out in the future, because the only reason it's out in the future is we don't have the medical system set up right. There's no reason we're not doing this today technologically.
Yeah, there's a person right there, second person in, who has a question.
I'm Dr. English. I was in general surgery for some time and now teaching at Georgetown in bioethics. All of this, these new capacities are absolutely exciting and wonderful and need to be done. Presently, we have too few general care practitioners, even though the nurses are beginning to save us a little bit as they go back into clinical work as primary care people. We need first adequate baselines, and of course with electronic records developed fully and completely for each patient. Even the patient that has 3 or 4 hours to drive, at some point he or she needs to be seen by the medical person and evaluated and having a rectal exam if that's needed to get the basic guidelines to begin with. In order to use the technology that you are exciting us about for specific or current acute problems, You cannot substitute telemedicine without the full story to begin with. Otherwise, you do what happened when I was in an HMO part-time while I was studying, where I saw a patient for 10 minutes. We were required to see four patients an hour. Totally inadequate. But you've got to have the baseline and know about the patient, know about the examination, know when the breast exam was done. That all has to be in the system before you can get into this sophistication. Finally, all physicians should be salaried in order to help reduce the conflicts of interest. We have our own ethical problems in the fact that probably over a third of us have interests in pharmaceutical, insurance, and freestanding medical situations, which bring in more money. Doctors don't need more money. We've always been well paid. Even in the Depression, my father managed fine. We don't need more money. We need the support to be able to be the kind of physicians that patients need. And you've got to have time with the patients to do that.
You know, I was with you until you gave that recto exam argument.
Don't go there.
You want to go ahead?
First of all, I'd like to say, since I'm the associate dean for CME, I have nothing to disclose, no conflict of interest. I don't consult for anybody, okay? But I will say, you know, I began my talk to say it's, for me, it's always been about specialty care because I am a strong believer in the primary care model as well, and I agree 100% that patients need access to primary care physicians. And unfortunately, our system is set up for disincentivizing that process. So I am 100% behind you on that, on your comments. I think there's a lot we can do, and we need to loop the primary care providers into these roles. And health information exchange, when the patient gets an electronic medical record, whether it's a personalized health record via any vendor, it needs to be able to talk to, you know, the community health center's electronic medical record needs to talk to mine, needs to talk to the patient's personalized record. That should be a major driver for our government, and it is, with the Office of the National Coordinator, a very critical piece. But I thank you for your comment because I agree 100%. And, you know, to the comment that was made earlier about you don't need to have coverage, I suffer so when I see so many uninsured patients who can't afford even to pay for their own medicine. It's a broken system. I volunteer at the Remote Area Medical Clinic in Wise, Virginia. It was covered in the New York Times, covered in the Washington Post. And the Remote Area Medical Organization went to L.A. Later this summer. We were down in Appalachia. 3,000 patients seen over one weekend who have no access to specialty care, limited access to primary care services. 50% of those patients actually had health insurance, but still they didn't have access to care and they couldn't pay for their medicine. So our system does need to be fixed, and I support you for your comments.
But I would have one additional comment to that, which is I think we should really save physicians for providing medical care. I mean, when I talk to physicians now, they're spending an inordinate amount of time on administrative stuff, paper keeping. I mean, there's a lot of stuff they do that they should not be doing. And I think that's where technology can come in to kind of relieve them of the tedium of stuff that has to get done. They shouldn't be the ones doing it. And it's too expensive of a use of their time to be using their time in that way. There's a question right there. Two people in. Yep.
My name is Sunita Bindal. I was with Motorola before. Wanted to find out, like, as we bring technology in the healthcare industry on our mobile phones, do we think the data plans would be coming down because they're so exorbitant compared to the rest of the world? Like, we do invent technology, but we don't use them in the U.S. as much as we do in the rest of the world. As a simple example, just the SMS, I think, is not heavily used in this part of the world compared to the rest of the world. So do we think that's a barrier to, you know, making it as commonly available to the rural areas as possible?
Yeah, I think affordability is a problem, you know, for lots of folks generally. We know that on the wireline side and on the wireless side as well. I think, interestingly, that's one of the things we haven't talked much today about broadband. We got excited about healthcare. There's kind of a growing recognition that we, just like healthcare needs a big global overhaul, that we need a big global look at broadband policy. And the FCC is doing that right now. And an element of that is affordability. And they are trying to put together a national broadband plan, so I think we'll see some, you know, some progress out of that. But I think the also, if you look at the data, I'm sure I'm obligated to say, that prices have actually gone down over time for what for data services. So, you know, I'm sure that that trend will continue, but I think there's a separate question about affordability. So we know in rural areas, incomes tend to be lower, people are poorer, and you combine kind of the lack of access with the affordability barrier and the income, and, you know, you've got a problem. You've got it on telephone service, you've got it on broadband, and you certainly have it on, you know, smartphone data plans.
I just want to across the room say a shout-out thank you to Senator Rockefeller, because Snow Rockefeller established the Rural Health Care Program, which is undergoing evolution, and but we could not do telemedicine in our rural communities without Universal Service Fund. And I know there's a look going forward for overhauling it, but when we started in 1995 to connect to a community health center in Appalachian, Virginia, cost us almost $6,000 a month for 1.54 megabits in both directions. With the Rural Health Care Program now, we can get that service for under $200 a month. So suddenly it is getting more affordable. If we can fix that program, you'd see us all jumping up and down saying thank you, thank you, thank you even more. That is the other major issue for us beyond reimbursement, frankly, is delivery of those broadband communication services. And it's moving forward. I mean, you know, the Telecom Act of 96 really made a difference in terms of getting out the competition and lowering the costs. There's more to be done as we look at the home as an environment and other previously ineligible entities.
So we're looking at, so the FCC has put a lot of focus on, thank you to the Snow Rockefeller bill, access to the rural healthcare facilities and to schools. And the FCC has long had a program that subsidized basic phone service to individuals. And I think now they are asking, is it time to go to subsidizing broadband access for people who are low income? And I think we'll see some, we at AT&T have supported that, and I think other people are supporting that, and we may see some progress on that at the FCC.
Okay, right there's a question.
Nelson Rosenbaum from Consumer Health Advisors. We build a comprehensive consumer health management portal. I'll make two quick comments. I think both of you have emphasized the importance of a comprehensive longitudinal personal health record. We agree with that. But I think there's absolutely no comprehension of the importance of that on Capitol Hill. In this current legislation, I've seen absolutely nothing to support that concept or that vision. There's plenty of support for an EMR, but nothing about a PHR. And until that switch goes off on Capitol Hill, I think we're going to have problems in enhancing consumerism. Number two, there are lots of state interstices here. I liked your comments about technology trumping privacy concerns. But in reality, when you get down to doing health information exchange in different states, there are lots of mental health laws and lots of laws about this and that that get in the way of health information exchange. And lots of state legislators get up on a stump and make speeches about privacy and so forth, create a lot of concern, fear, that is really in the way of effective consumerism and health information exchange. Whether you want to comment on those or not, I think we have to reckon with those two barriers. Thanks.
Okay. Right there.
Hi, Ryan from ZocDoc. From a physician standpoint, I know what you're doing on the technology end for compliance, but that was one of my concerns. My wife and I actually just recently had a premature baby, and we were sent home with the monitor, and I know the follow-up calls when we weren't monitoring. But what do you see out there in terms of compliance? Is basically 90% of these home monitoring things being complied with, or what's your feedback so far?
The patients are very accepting of the technology. I've had patients who are even unsavvy said, this is so wonderful. I don't want to come back. I want to keep using these technologies. So I think once you engage the patient, I think they will be very, very compliant, and there are reminders in the technology to make them be compliant or to facilitate their compliance. So I think it is terrific. They are terrific tools, and I think patients are very, very accepting. One of my first telemedicine encounters actually was with one of my congenital heart disease patients. He had just had surgery, and I sort of cajoled his mother into coming to a small community hospital, and we tested the network, and we, you know, the sonographer was there. She had never done a pediatric echo, and she's sitting there like this really nervous, and the mother was there, and the baby was there. And after it was over, I said to the mom, well, what'd you think? She said, tell everyone, I'm not coming back to your hospital if I don't have to. That's how accepting patients are, because it's so much better than disrupting your lives for travel and getting timely intervention. So hopefully consumers will fully adopt it, and remains to be seen.
Okay. Right here, we have a question. Right there on the aisle. Yep.
My name is Dmitry Novik. I have three questions to all of you. First question to Mr. I don't remember your name. I'm sorry.
West.
But anyhow, I have a chance to read your paper before. And my question is this. You said that patient must be in charge of healthcare. It's absolutely wrong idea. Doctor must be in charge. It's unbelievable how you can. So my question is this. Do you really think that patient must be in charge in healthcare system?
I would say they just need to be more in charge, because right now patients are the past.
In charge, it nothing more or less. Okay, I understand your.
Okay.
Now I have questions for you. What about that your device and sensor give some mistake in the system? It will be terrible. Tell me, please, how you ensure that all your devices is absolutely truthful? How? What's the service? It's. Do you calculate what it will cost if it will for 30 million patients to have this food device and this? For the record, I'm professional. It will never happen. Your devices will never be on the market. It's wrong investment from AT&T. Because you need to be serious, not fantasy. It's, you need to be practitioners.
Okay, now what's your last question? What's your last question, please?
And I have a question for you. In 1993, I have very successful demonstration in Walter Reed and John Hopkins Hospital X-ray images transmission with increasing speed by through telephone line, because it was not internet available at this time, 100 times quicker and 100 times cheaper, of course. Why it wasn't implemented around? Very simple. Because doctor, in any telemedicine, the main organizing problem is your doctor must to have license in different state. It's crazy. It's a problem.
Okay, so.
The question, no, I have a question.
Okay, please, give us your question.
And question is this. You are president of Telemedicine Association. You're a practitioner in this field. What technological problem you have? Give me one the most.
Of technology?
Or you have not.
Very few that can't be accomplished with technology. Compression, you know, standards for transmitting images are there. What we need is more funding for some of the technologies, even to develop the standards. So I think there isn't anything we can't solve with technology if we have sufficient funding and sound policies to implement it. And so all it takes is funding and the good policy at the federal and state level, and consumer adoption. But we can do it with technology.
No, excuse me. We have some other people who want to ask questions. Can we get a question over here, please?
Thank you. I'm Dr. Caroline Poplin. I'm a primary care physician. I retired from Bethesda Naval Hospital a couple of years ago. I have one comment, quick, and a question for Dr. Rubin. The comment is, it's wonderful that we can get all this data from patients. The last thing I want in my office is data piling up, and I don't have time to look at it. Somewhere in that data is something I need to know, and I don't get to it till the next day, and in the meantime, the patient's in the hospital. That's a terrible situation. So along with the data, we have to be paid for time to look at the data. There was a study, I think, in the Annals of Internal Medicine about the VA with its great electronic health records. Half of the CTs that were done that picked up an incidental aortic aneurysm were never looked at by the physicians, even though they got an electronic notice that there was an abnormality on a CT. The question is, have you ever thought of using the Indian Health Service or maybe the Public Health Service for the telemedicine? It sounds like Indian reservations would be the perfect place, and the Indian Health Service has its own pot of money, and it's probably not constrained by state licensing standards.
Thank you for that question. Actually, the Indian Health Service is very much involved with telemedicine. Dr. Mark Carroll, who's a pediatrician, is on our board. He's very involved in all the federal policy issues, and they are providing telemedicine services on the reservations. In fact, at our annual meeting, he took a side trip to the bottom of the Grand Canyon to launch a telemedicine initiative at the very bottom of the Grand Canyon in one of the little teeny reservations. So they are very, very involved. Same thing with Alaska. The tribal consortia in Alaska have very heavily invested in telemedicine. I might add, 63% of the rural health care funds actually go to Alaska. And again, you know, I stated earlier, I agree 100% with your premise that we don't, as doctors, have enough time to sit there and look at all that data. So we need computer support to and people to review the outliers and identify and react to the challenges. I'm behind you 100%.
But if I could push your question one additional level, this is where I thought you were going, the legal liability question. Like, if people are using these remote monitoring devices, all the data is flooding into physician offices, they don't have time to look at it, they miss something, they're going to get sued.
I agree. We will.
Well, what do we do about it?
We have to be
look
smarter about what we do with the data when it comes in. And we have to train. It's another group of health professionals, I think, or more nurses, or more advanced practice nurses, or more doctors to help us with all of this data. I think there are technology solutions to help us with our problems with technology.
But if all that is true, does that mean we're going to save less money? Because we may just
redistribute these steps. It may be an initial greater investment in order to be able to save money long term.
To me, it goes back to the question someone asked about reorganizing the practices. And if Mayo talks a lot about this, that there really isn't a system now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got an amalgam of people doing things and there's no system. And I think the technology does, you know, call out for a better system, methods and procedures, the larger sense of the word system, to manage all of those issues. It in some ways highlights what has always been a failing if you have this data. And it highlighted for you what the problem was and there was no way to act on it. You know, it's really just highlighting a problem that we have today.
Okay,
or exposing.
I think we have time just for one or two more questions. So we'll take one right there.
My name is Eric Garvan. Real quick question. In terms of building infrastructure, what kind of bandwidth do we actually need in order to communicate the images that we are projecting, let's say, 10, 15 years in the future? The other thing is, what is the scale of the legacy data that has to be added into the system in order to build the types of records that give a historical picture of a particular patient or a group of patients? Like, what is the scale? And then again, in terms of building infrastructure, can we even handle it with the bandwidth that we currently have now?
So I can address the bandwidth question, and I think the answer is it actually depends on the technology. You know, a lot of the stuff we talked about is not a giant bandwidth consumer. Some of the stuff is, if you're talking about, you know, remote surgery using real-time video that has to be high resolution, that's obviously big bandwidth. But if you're talking about store and forward, it doesn't have to be a giant bandwidth. And if you're talking about this kind of thing, that's actually not bandwidth intensive at all. And then some of what we talked about was text messaging. That's, you know, not even broadband. So there's obviously exponentially increasing need for demand, but I don't think a lot of this is a, a bandwidth barrier today. I think the other barriers are bigger, which is different than saying, you know, Karen needs to be able to buy the connectivity she needs at the places she needs it, but those aren't at speeds that are impossible today. It's just, as you say, a funding question. You know, we can deliver her that stuff if she had the money to pay for it.
And scalability?
It's going to be a big investment, frankly, especially as we implement large-scale electronic medical records and personal health records. It's going to be very costly, and the federal government is investing a lot of money in interoperability and adoption of electronic medical records and, you know, sort of the equivalent of, like, the Farm Bureau. There's going to be, electronic medical record cooperatives to help people deploy in their offices, but it's going to be a huge investment. I think in terms of one of the other questions about the bandwidth, I mean, compression algorithms can help us, but for live interactive, we do need at least, you know, quarter T1 at a minimum to have something that's acceptable to the doctors and acceptable to the patient. It doesn't work if you're trying to talk to a patient and it's a choppy image. So, you know, again, as Ellen said, it depends on what the application is. But there are solutions that can be developed to address those challenges as well.
Especially in the middle of surgery.
Right.
I'm still not convinced on this remote surgery concept. Well, maybe that's just me.
I have to take the opportunity to also talk about kind of a network management kind of issue, is that some of these things can be managed in prioritization. If you're doing a store and forward, you don't have to do that, you know, right away. That bit can go second. But if you're doing a real-time surgery, you know, that bit has to go right away. So it's not always just building a bigger pipe. There's lots that can be done with technologies on the compression side and on the network management side. And who knows what else they will invent.
Okay, we have time for one last question right here.
Hi, I'm David Stewart with CSC. We're talking about collecting all this data and responding to it. But the next step is collecting all this data. How do you use it, or where do you see the early adopters taking that data and using it to improve outcomes and make better decisions within healthcare and improving communities?
I'll take the first stab at it. Chronic disease management, I mean, I think that is the best application. It's what's costing our government. It's costing patients. It's a huge hardship, especially when you're dealing with patients who are at a distance. So I think chronic disease management is the number one place to start. Reduce the burden of diabetes, reduce the burden of heart failure. There's a lot that can be done. And if we can develop sound policies to address what we can do with technology, I think we'll go a long way.
Yeah, I guess I would just add that I think the folks working on the EMRs, or the meaningful use definition, do have their eye on that, in that they have tried to define they tried to keep in mind the thing they want reported out as they're doing the definition, so that you have a kind of useful data at the end of the day that can compare, you know, across time and space. Well, space, people.
Okay, we are out of time, but I want to thank Ellen Blackler from AT&T and Dr. Karen Rubin from the University of Virginia for their insightful comments, and thank you for all of your great questions as well.